Welcome to PCMC. I'm Mike Bongiorno. I'm joined today by my good friend and yours, Mr. Pete Marsh. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great.
Today, we are talking about a film that is near and dear to my heart, and I think maybe your heart too, Masters of the Universe from 1987, produced by Canon, the A24 of its time.
Oh, yeah. Globus and Gorham, right? Those two guys. Yeah. Have you ever watched that documentary about Canon?
Yeah, Electric Boogaloo, I have.
Oh, I love that documentary.
There's a great anecdote from that documentary about this film where supposedly Sylvester Stallone visited the set of Masters of the Universe.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw Dolph Lundgren playing He-Man, and Dolph Lundgren had played the villain in Rocky IV. And he saw him talking, and he was like, oh man, you gave that guy dialogue? Dolph Lundgren is struggling to not sound Swedish throughout this movie.
Yeah. This movie, it's funny because like there's so many like legends about this movie, and they talk about it in that documentary. And one of them is about how they were going to dub Dolph Lundgren and they were going to use some other actor's voice. I think they ended up dubbing it with his own voice afterwards to make it sound clearer. But
yeah,
it's just so funny because he's such a smart person. He's got like PhDs and stuff like that. Yeah.
And like chemistry.
And I think he's very charismatic in general. But everyone always talks about how, like, you know, he struggled to play He-Man. And I don't know. I think he's likable. I like him in this movie.
Well, you know, I cannot divorce my... This is one of those films where my critical adult, you know, cinematic brain really has a hard time divorcing itself from my child brain.
Yep.
But I could say that I did not notice that as a kid. I never noticed that there was something weird about his voice. I mean, he doesn't speak a lot. He doesn't have a lot of dialogue.
No.
But it's not like I totally, as a kid, was like, oh, he's got a weird voice. Because I also remember him as the Punisher. And I never had a problem with that movie either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this movie, it's crazy. You know, it's so funny that you and I met in college, because I think about my philosophy classes, and I know there's some kind of philosophical argument where, like, something could be two opposite things at the same time. Like, it could be like in the box and outside of the box. This movie is like simultaneously a bad movie and a great movie at the same time, you know?
Yes, I agree.
Well, I don't think that necessarily it's all nostalgia either. When I watch this movie, I'm like, okay, essentially, if you had like a scale, it has these negative points that you could, as a critic, you know, you could point out and have issues with, but then it also has these like strong qualities that as a critic you could be like, yeah, but it has this too.
Yeah.
You know?
Agree. If I did see this now for the first time, I wouldn't think it's spectacular, but I would think it's charming. Yesterday, I was watching it for the 1,000,000th time, and it occurred to me that the closest movie that I could think of like this is the Flash Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's got really outlandish production design and a really, really great actor playing the villain and like really playing it up. But the difference is, I think Flash Gordon really drags in the middle, whereas this movie really goes. This movie is tight. You know, like if you just look at it in terms of plotting, it's like boom, 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 boom. Everything gets you to the next thing. Everything's moving fast. There's no fat on the bone, really. It's not a boring movie.
No. I think that Flash comparison is great because, like, probably the thing that stands out the most about Flash Gordon is the score by Queen. There's so many different parts in Flash Gordon that you remember and think about, but it's that Queen score. And then this movie has this really, really strong score, which I'm sure we're going to, like, make fun of in a second and be like, oh, well, it's just like, you know, Superman and Star Wars, right?
Yeah.
But it's like you feel it when Skeletor walks into that throne room, and like Skeletor has an exact theme. He-Man's got a theme. There's a theme that's connected to the key itself.
And the two, like, young kids, the two human teenagers, they have a theme.
Yeah. And that's something that is like sadly missing from modern movies, where there's not like a specific theme for a character. It's like something that when we were growing up, movies were just filled with, and it teaches you, like, emotionally, okay, this is how you're supposed to feel in this moment. And this movie, all the themes are really great. Like, Skeletor's theme is really great. It conveys a certain kind of emotion. The He-Man theme is really great.
Yeah,
you know, I think, like, that's a really great plus for this movie.
Yeah, I think movies right now are in a place where they're using the score more as a sort of an aesthetic or a vibe. Like, a lot of people don't like this movie, but the Justice League, not the Snyder version, the original, the version that came out in theaters, that was scored by Danny Elfman.
Right.
And he used some of his Batman theme in that movie from the 1989 movie. And there's a reviewer that was like, you know, you use a little bit of John Williams' Superman theme and you use a little bit of the Batman theme. And he's like, yeah, because it's important. And so they said, like, what Batman theme did you use? And he was like, what do you mean, what Batman theme? There's only ever been one Batman theme, and it's the one I made.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the Dark Knight doesn't have a theme for Batman, really. You know, there's the dun, 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 but that's not assigned to any character. That's just reacting to something happening in the narrative.
Yes. I'm so glad that you brought up Zack Snyder in particular, because I know that Zack Snyder has gotten in trouble for essentially taking themes from movies and then, like, reworking them and putting them onto his movies. Like, there's that movie, Titus, I think it's called, with, like, Anthony Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses that music almost, like, exactly in 300. Right.
Really?
So I think that, yeah. Yeah. I think what happens when they make movies nowadays is they'll say, okay, use this theme from this movie, and we're going to use it as, like, a placeholder for our music. And often they, like, are just slightly changing the music for their own movie, you know? And it just kind of shows that there isn't that kind of John Williams, that James Horner, you know, there isn't that kind of person that's making these specific themes for these characters in movies these days.
Yeah, you know? The score to Masters of the Universe is by Bill Conti, who did a lot of things, but probably his biggest thing was Rocky, right? Mm. And the Rocky theme is, like, iconic, right? One of the most iconic themes in movies.
Absolutely.
It's interesting when you look at this cast and crew, like, a lot of these are really skilled people.
Oh yeah.
I want to talk about I want to go everyone who worked on this movie. I did make the decision that I'm not going to mention the director of this film, because the director of this film is a terrible person. And I'm not trying to ignore him, but I feel like he doesn't deserve to have his name spoken in the hallowed halls of PCMC.
Yes.
But it also gives us an opportunity to look at other people, because, and I'm guilty of this too, quite often people assign every artistic choice to the director. Oh, did you see what the director did with that? The director did that. And the people that work hard and making really important decisions that become unsung are costume designers and production designers and editors and all these people. Masters of the Universe, this film was written by David O'Dell.
Mm-hmm.
There was a rewrite by Stephen Tolkien and a third person.
Mm-hmm.
Produced by Cannon.
Mm-hmm.
The composer was Bill Conti, as we just said.
Mm-hmm.
The cinematographer was Hania Baer, who did a bunch of stuff. Ernest Scared Stupid is another one of hers that I like.
A masterpiece.
Yeah, but this is really great. It's edited by Ann V. Coates, who did Out of Sight and Eric Brockovich and a lot of good stuff. The production designer was William Stout, who worked on a lot of cool things in a lot of interesting capacities.
Mm-hmm.
But even he will be open about he hired Mobius to work with him, and Mobius created the updated character design of He-Man and Skeletor and or maybe not Skeletor, but the He-Man and the Sorceress and She-Ra. There's a She-Ra that was originally designed that ended up not being in this movie. Look up Mobius She-Ra, and it's like,
oh my God.
It's like, I want the multiverse where I could see the Mobius She-Ra. Yeah, Mobius, because I think the designs of He-Man and all of them, the updated designs, I think are very cool. And once you hear, like, oh, it's Mobius, it's like, oh, yeah, of course, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And I hear Jodorowsky's voice going, Mobius!
Right, right. Oh, my God, that is so cool that you brought up Jodorowsky, too, right? Because isn't there, like, a part in Jodorowsky's Dune where they, like, cite this movie, too?
Yes.
Like, don't they say that this is, like, an influence? Or, I'm sorry, that his Dune was an influence on this?
Yeah, I mean, in that movie, they talk about one of the really flawed things that he did was when he was creating his Dune, he created, like, a Bible of all of his script and the production notes and, like, basically, like, a blueprint of the whole movie. And he thought it would be a good idea to send it out to all the major studios.
Yeah.
Like, that would, like, entice them to want to work with him, which didn't happen. But the belief is that for, like, decades to come, they were mining this material for their movies, and they show, like, Alien and Masters of the Universe and even some of the later Star Wars. And it's like, yeah, like, there's definitely, like, some of Jodorowsky's Dune in the production design of this movie.
Oh, man, we are such fucking nerds where we're quoting Jodorowsky's Dune while we're talking about Masters of the Universe. Yeah. Right?
Yeah, a movie that doesn't exist.
Right, right. But it doesn't exist, but yet somehow it is like the beginning of so many movies too. Yeah, like even like fucking like Terminator, the original Terminator, there's like his vision in it is like kind of based on this hunter seeker vision in Jodorowsky's Dune. Yeah, it's so cool. I mean, like, you got to think about that throne room, which they use like over and over and again in this movie, right? Like that's
Mobius
so...
worked on that throne room.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that is so, like, evocative of the, like, the Emperor in Dune and, like, his throne room and, like, you know.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I mean, I'm glad that we're not talking about the director. We're not giving him the attention that he deserves. But we should talk about influences, which I think that, like, this particular influence comes from him.
Yes.
But there is the big thing where they compare this movie to Jack Kirby's The Fourth World, which is like a part of DC Comics and their lore. You know, they compare like Skeletor to Darkseid. They compare Gwildor to this guy Metron. Like for your friends that aren't, or listeners or whatever, that aren't like diehard crazy comic book people, Metron's this guy that like floats around in a chair and he's kind of like neutral in all the sort of big DC events. But the old gods are kind of like a big part of the mythology of DC Comics. And John Byrne, who's a comic book artist and writer, said that like Masters of the Universe 1987 is like the closest thing to a old gods or they call it Fourth World movie. Have you ever heard about that?
No, I'm not familiar. I'm familiar with Darkseid, but I'm not familiar with that stuff, that material.
Yeah, yeah. It's like classic like good versus evil stuff, but it's like Jack Kirby just off a leash and, you know, unleashed or whatever. And, you know, you have like Apocalypse, which is the planet of the bad guys. And you have Darkseid as the ruler there. Then you have New Genesis, which is like the good guys. And you have Highfather, which is like the good guy there, the leader. And he has a son named Orion that's like his adoptive son. And there's a guy named Mr. Miracle, who's a big DC character from there. But one person pointed out that, like, Masters of the Universe isn't a one-to-one comparison between the two. It's just, like, really inspired
by
Jack Kirby's Fourth World stuff. And I've heard someone else say that, like, it might be the director saying that, like, this movie was inspired by that stuff, but it was also inspired by, like, the Fantastic Four kind of Doctor Doom epics. And then it was also inspired by, like, old Thor comics. So it's very inspired by comic books.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if you look at, like, it's interesting because there's an evolution from the animated series to this, right? Whereas the animated series is a fascinating blend between sort of sword and sandal fantasy and kind of, I'm not sure, space opera sci-fi, like kind of Star Wars sci-fi, right? Like, there's a king and queen, and then they're wearing loincloths, and, you know, there's a sort of desolate wasteland, but then there's also, like, spaceships and things like that. In the film, you still have that interesting juxtaposition of fantasy and sci-fi, but I think it's slightly different. I think you've got more cyberpunk kind of sci-fi happening. And I think Mobius brought some of that. And in terms of fantasy, this occurred to me yesterday. I wrote it down. In terms of fantasy, it's not really sword and sandal. It's more like
High fantasy.
Yeah.
Like Lord of the Rings type stuff. Like,
yes,
you know,
yes.
Yeah.
Frodo's a hobbit. He lives in a hobbit hole. He lives in like a hobbit hole that they put sci-fi stuff in.
Right. You know, like you bring up Gwildor and like the fact that he's like this little kind of cute fantasy creature, but on the good guy's side, there really isn't any kind of magical fantasy stuff. They're just kind of like these warriors. I'm talking about in the movie. They're just kind of like these warriors in this like resistance. Whereas like the real magic stuff is the bad guy stuff, right? Because like Skeletor, obviously, like he shoots lightning out of his hand. Evelyn pretends to be Courtney Cox's mom at one point.
Yeah.
The whole idea of like that Skeletor is going to take the sorceress's power or the power of Grayskull by the next moon. Like that's all fantasy stuff. But you're on the bad guy side. Like I think one of the notorious things about this movie is that, and I'm sure I'm kind of beating you to the punch here, but like there's no Prince Adam, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not like He-Man raises up the sword or Prince Adam raises up the sword and becomes He-Man. There's nothing like that. He's just He-Man the whole time. And even when he pulls out the sword, it really is just to be like, see, this is He-Man. Like we're doing the thing.
Right.
But there's no like reason why like the sword does anything for him.
Right. The sword is not a magical totem in this. It's not until the very end of the movie when Skeletor takes his sword that they assign any importance to it.
Right.
It's not the MacGuffin. I mean, the key is the MacGuffin.
Right.
But the key is very magical because Gwildor says to the Kevin character, the Earth character, he says the existence is music. The universe is music. So the key is almost like a TARDIS, and you can travel in time and space as long as you know the right notes to play on the cosmic key.
Yeah.
And by the way, talk about production design. I love the cosmic key. I've always loved the cosmic key. I would love to get a tattoo of the cosmic key. It's such a cool looking thing. I love the way it's the music it makes. I love the projection that comes on the top of the key and the things that move.
Yeah.
I think the production design in this movie is absolutely awesome and incredible.
Yes. Yeah. Let's talk about the cosmic key for a second because, you know, it has that kind of synthesizer sound to it when it's playing, like, and when it's activated, you know, it's like, and then it's like, bow, that synthesizer noise. They even, like, you know, Kevin kind of compares it to like a Japanese synthesizer at one point when he discovers it. But there's something about the power in just those notes when it's like that synthesizer noise where it's like, bow, like you feel the magic just from the sound that's essentially coming from a keyboard off screen, right? But I want to talk about that Masters of the Universe cartoon and magic and stuff like that, because I think that's a really good point. It's a really good thing to kind of discuss in this movie. Because one thing I totally forgot to mention when I was comparing this to all that Jack Kirby stuff is that all the people from New Genesis and Apocalypse, all that DC mythology shit, they use these things called boom tubes. Mm-hmm. And they're even in that fucking Zack Snyder Justice League movie, too. Boom tubes are basically like these like portable devices that like can give you answers to any questions that you have. They might maybe can like shoot blasts and stuff. But the main thing that the boom tube does is it opens up a portal between one world and another. So you can just walk through from one world to another. And that's what the cosmic key is, right? It's just like a boom tube, right? It opens up this doorway and you go from eternity to Earth. Now this movie, what's so interesting about this movie and canon in general, is that they're notorious for like burning through money and not having enough money to make their movies. And so that's why you have this movie that's like this like suburban He-Man with desolate streets where they film everything. And then you have all this money spent on this throne room. But like with fantasy movies in general, especially in the 80s, it's so common for like a character to go from this like fantasy world setting to the real world setting.
Yeah.
Right. And it is like a cost effective thing. But like this movie, I think is maybe like the biggest example of that. Can you think of a bigger example than that?
No.
Yeah.
But yes, absolutely, that's what happens. But again, I to defend this, and I'm not defending it because you're not criticizing it, but
Right.
to argue why I think this movie really works is I think they use, of all the canon movies, except for like the fight at the very end, they use their money right. They put it in the right places. You begin in Eternia and you end in Eternia, which is smart. And I would even say, when you get to Earth, I think they do a good job, not matching the fantasy of Eternia, but creating interesting looking spaces. Like you've got, the fried chicken place that she works, where they dress like cowgirls. You've got a cemetery. You've got a high school prom where it's all like made up like a prom and really interesting looking. Now, a lot of it's empty because they didn't have really any extras, but that adds an uncanny feeling to it. The music shop, Charlie's music shop, I think is very interesting. There's a whole siege battle in that shop. Behind the school, I guess, is like, I don't know what, like a weird like gated off area with like shipping fucking like with like boxes and stuff. A lot of that is lit with neon signs and stuff. Like wet streets, which is like a something they do for lighting. I feel like they actually do a really good job, even like when they're in her house, right? And she's getting ready to move. She's moving from California to New Jersey. What a downgrade. She's like, I'm leaving California to start a new life in New Jersey. But her house, which is probably the most like domestic space, is filled with boxes, moving boxes. So even that is made odd in a way. They do a good job making the mundane interesting and combining the mundane with the fantastical. Like at some point, Gwildor gets them a pink Cadillac and like fixes it up Doc Brown style and like makes it like somehow run on some kind of crazy sci-fi shit. And that's what they drive around in. And it's like that's really smart because it's not a sci-fi vehicle, right? It's taking a real world car that's iconic, a pink Cadillac that's a convertible, and just sci-fying it up a little bit, but it's still interesting to look at.
No, I mean, this is a really great path you got going on here because, like, it does make the movie feel unique and different. Like, the empty streets and stuff, because they didn't have extras, it reminds me of like Night of the Comet, you know, like where all the
Yes.
people are missing, right? It has this kind of almost like post-apocalyptic feel, but it's got that 80s, like we're having an apocalyptic event, but we're in like a suburban town. So it
Yes.
feels like desolate and empty, but it's really just because they didn't have people. And I think that like if they did have a lot of extras and you did have like He-Man and Teela and Man at Arms like interacting with a lot of different people, it would feel more hokey and stuff. And
Yes, I
like
agree.
you know, Courtney Cox, Julie and Kevin, that they do have their moments of like, what is going on? Or like, this looks weird. And then you have like Lubick, who's like, what the hell is this? And they both have the same reaction to like when they see Gwildor, they're like, what the hell is that? When they see
Yeah.
him, right? But it's like they quickly take on the story of Eternia. Like, it's not like there's multiple scenes where there's other people that meet them and they're like, this is so weird. Or like, look at this guy walking around in a loincloth. Like,
Yeah.
it doesn't have that fish out of water stuff as much when it comes to the humans reacting to Eternians, you know?
Yes. No, yeah, I agree. There's really one corny part where there's a bunch of monsters in like a high school kitchen where like those big industrial like fridges and stuff, and it's just like this looks weird. And then the janitor's like, "You kids can't be in here," which is like, "Those look like kids to you?" Those are, and then they beat the shit out of
They really do. Yeah. And
them.
I really want to talk about the monsters, the mercenaries in one second. But before we get to that, I just want to do one more thing about influences. Like I said before, they mentioned Thor being an influence for this movie, right? The
Yeah.
Thor comics. And I think it's like there's the inverse, right? I feel like this movie is a big inspiration on the Thor movie. Have you seen the original Thor
Yes,
movie?
yes, I agree.
Well, because just like, I mean, because this is always the thing with comics and fantasy and stuff like that, is that you always have to have this device that connects the fantasy world, the high fantasy world, to the regular world. So people can, and right? And so like with the fourth world stuff, it's boom tubes. With Asgard and Thor, it's like the rainbow bridge, right?
Yes.
To Earth. And it's the same thing with this fucking movie where they have the cosmic key. And so, like, in comics and stuff, it's the idea of, well, we need to have, like, the relatable scenario. We need to have the scenario where, like, regular normie people can get into this weird shit.
Yeah.
Right? But I think that in this movie, it is that, but it's also, like, we just don't have enough money to do Eternia stuff, so we have to make it suburban.
I haven't seen every single canon film. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of them. I'm sure you have too. Mm-hmm. I think this is, of what I've seen, this is the most competent canon film. It really mm-hmm. is. I mean, mm-hmm. you look at, like, the other side of the spectrum would be Superman 4, which really, you could just feel it has none of the magic of a Superman movie. It just feels so cheap. It feels the money's never spent in the right place. It's choppy. It's horrible. This is at least I think competent.
Yeah,
I think, you know, I really think the movie, and this we should say, this movie did fail. I think the reason the movie failed was because you know, He-Man was on its way out. See, like, Mattel, this toy company, their two big things were Barbie and He-Man. And Barbie was a sort of constant success, whereas He-Man was a sort of like a huge peak that, like, they completely, like, they had no idea it was going to be that huge, and it, like, took over the world, and then a decline. And by 1987, when this movie comes out, it's already on, there are no new episodes being made. Right, there's only, I mean, it's a syndicated show, so there's only one technical season of He-Man. Mm-hmm. So there's no new episodes being made. There's toys still being made, but the sales are not doing as well as they were, you know, in like 85. You know,
right. It
was huge. I don't want to say splash in the pan because that makes it sound like it was not, it didn't have value, but it kind of took everything by storm and then kind of like faded away. And this was already the downslope. Like, when mm-hmm. the trailers came out, people were like, oh, wow, okay. Remember, like, when, like, three years ago or, like, 4 years ago, there was an Angry Birds movie?
Right.
And
right.
everyone was like, what is this, 2007? Like, way to be way too late on the fucking bandwagon. That's how people felt with Master Universe. Like, oh, a He-Man movie now?
Yeah.
Like, but I think the movie itself, I think, is actually has an inherent value. It's just, I think the world was just kind of like, you know, probably kids had moved on, you know, mm-hmm. they were now interested in, like, you know, G.I. Joe or other things and Transformers or something.
Hell yeah.
You know, it's something I want to, we're all over the place, which is fine because we have a lot of feelings about this movie.
Yeah.
I don't want to leave something, which is I want to talk about the very opening.
Sure.
I've always thought the very opening is actually really effective and iconic.
Hell yeah.
You hear like a boom, and we see a shot, which is a matte painting of Grayskull, which again, right. It doesn't, I love this Grayskull. It doesn't look like the Grayskull of the cartoon,
right?
Which is like a stone kind of like castle. This looks very cyberpunk and sci-fi, but still has a skull image of it. And there's this narrator who says, at the center of the universe, at the border between the light and the dark, stands Castle Grayskull. For countless ages, the sorcerers of Grayskull has kept this universe in harmony. But the armies of darkness do not rest, and the capture of Grayskull is ever most in their minds. For those that control Grayskull will come the power to be supreme, the power to be almighty, the power to be masters of the universe. And then the Bill Conti, bum, ba, da, da.
Right.
And
yeah.
You just talked about the bridge in Thor. When the title comes up, Masters of the Universe, it's the same like design or font, I guess, or whatever, of you know, that was that's been on the toys, Masters of the Universe. But yes. instead of the color that you're used to, it's got this very bright, like iridescent color behind it, like pinks and blues. And that reminds me of the bridge in Thor.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, there's that inspiration right there. You know, like I said, the three big inspirations were the Fourth World stuff, Fantastic Four and Doctor Doom, and then Thor. And yeah, that's a big thing, man. And yeah, the intro is so fucking good because it's got that grayskull picture. It also does show like the sorceress in like a very dynamic shot where it's like over her shoulder and it's like her looking up at the sky, you know? Yeah. So, you know, it's just the choice of the shot right there is very exciting and dramatic because it's not just like showing her face or like it could have been really corny and just kind of like faded her onto the screen and then faded her out. That would be like some real B movie or like 80s movie cheese, but over her shoulder and looking up and yeah. And then the score, of course, like you've said it to me before that, like when it comes in, it's just like Superman, the movie where it's like, you know, the names are flying up at you. And then,
I love it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It gets you pumped. But that brings up the thing I wanted to ask you too, which is like, when did you first see this movie and how old were you?
I guess I was right when it came out. I mean, my dad has great memories of this movie because, like I have a He-Man tattoo. I have He-Man sword from the cartoon tattooed on my wrist. And when I showed it to my dad, he was like, "Oh, you loved that when you were a baby." Because I was born in 1983, I was born the same month the cartoon came out, September 1983. So like the cartoon was around, but this movie really more than anything is the thing about He-Man I like the most, which probably makes me unique to like older He-Man fans that are like, that's your favorite thing. I watched it every day. I mean, according to my parents, I watched it every day. Like they had it on VHS and every day I'd be like, put on He-Man. And they'd put on He-Man. Like this is before I went to school. Like not before school in the morning, like before I was old enough to go to school. Like I was a baby. And who knows? Like, it's so funny. Like who knows what I was getting from it? Like, you know what I mean? Like, but I must have just loved watching He-Man running around hitting people and stuff. And I watched it every day when I was like 4 or 5 years old. It's such an early move. It's so early. It's so fundamental.
Yeah.
What about you? What's your history with the film?
Yeah, I'm just 1 year older than you. And I don't think I saw it in the theater. I think that like my parents got it on VHS. There's quite a few movies from my childhood where my first exposure to them is seeing them on VHS.
Sure, right? Me too.
And then there's movies that like I would watch over and over and over again. It's like, okay, that makes sense why you're the person you are. Like, I think I just watched like Return of the Jedi like over and over and over again, right? Or I watched the Transformers, the movie over and over and over again.
This one
I watched too. And it's funny because I used to watch the He-Man cartoon as a kid. But this movie stands out. And I always remember, like, I think my mom had this reaction. I know I, as a kid, had this reaction, but it was like, whoa, this is like way darker and scarier than the cartoon, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Skeletor goes from like, hey, everybody, I'm Skeletor, to like the fucking devil. Like, he's like, the Skeletor-ness is like half Palpatine, half like Skeletor from the cartoon. I mean, that's a really great choice in terms of design, in terms of writing, in terms of performance. Like Skeletor in the cartoon was like, he was moving and doing stuff and fighting He-Man. Like in this, he's like regal. He's like, you were talking before about his entrance. His entrance is so good. You hear his staff like clung, clung, hitting the marble floors of the throne room. And we hear this theme that's, the Skeletor theme. And we see his back and he, both He-Man and Skeletor in this get capes, which I think is a good design choice. Agreed. And he's like got these like silver, he actually does look a little bit like Ming from
Flash Gordon.
Flash Gordon, yeah. He and Frank Langella, Fred, see, this is one of these, I would put this in bed with like Gene Hackman in Superman, and even like I would put, this may be a weird comparison, Jim Carrey in Sonic, of like you get a really, really good actor to play a bad guy in a kind of silly movie, and they just fucking go for it 100%.
Yeah, it's so funny you said that you would put this in bed with it, and I just pictured Gene Hackman's Lex Luthor in bed with his Skeletor, and I pictured Skeletor, you know, when he comes out of the water at the end of the movie, like, and he's like, I'll be back.
Yeah.
I pictured him, like, in bed, and that's him poking up in the covers, looking up at Gene Hackman. I don't know where my mind's going this morning, but...
No, I don't know who'd be the top and who'd be the bottom in that situation. They're both so powerful.
Oh, yes, yeah. I think like Gene Hackman's Lex would be the bottom, but he'd be like very disinterest. You know, he just would be like, whatever. But anyway, I don't even know where I'm going with this, but like this movie, when people talk about this movie, they mainly talk about like the budget and how like it's cheesy. And they do talk about how like it came out too late, like you said before. But I think the main thing they talk about with this movie is Frank Langella's Skeletor performance. Yes. You know, and you know, it's so funny that like we're kind of deep into this review, and like this is when we first start talking about it, but like it is like kind of transcendent for this movie. Like his performance makes this movie way better than it needs to be.
Yes, I agree. He does a way better job than he needed to do. I mean, he does way more than a serviceable job. He like really is going for it. And like, see, like his version of Skeletor, I think, is the one that means most to me. And I think if you look at like Kevin Smith's Skeletor in his animated series on Netflix now, I feel like he's getting a lot from this movie. There's a lot of references to this movie in the Kevin Smith show, like Gwildor's in it now and Blade and stuff like that. The line, let this be our final battle. And I feel like, to me, that the mythos of this Skeletor, because this Skeletor, you get the feeling is like he's more like Darth Vader. He doesn't get his hands dirty himself. He well, first of all, he has like stormtroopers. Like, it's not just in the cartoon, there's a band of good guys and a band of bad guys, but in this, there are Skeletor has stormtroopers, and then we don't see it a lot, but there's an Eternian army too. You see some of them captured. So, like, there's more of a Star Wars element. And there's also laser guns, which you don't see that much in the cartoon. But, yeah, this Skeletor, you get the... And also, like, his relationship to Evelyn seems very intimate and sexual in this. But also, like, you know, he's, like, menacing in this very subtle way. Like, he raises his voice a few times. Like, the very first thing he says is, no! And he turns around, and it's, like, this great opening. But then, like, he's very, like, sort of, like, sarcastic and sardonic and sort of, like, the way he, like, he's got the staff, the way he, like, wraps his fingers around the staff slowly. There's something, like, I don't know what, like, lizard-like about the way he moves and the way he moves his hand. Even, like, when there's close-ups of him, he's always darting his eyes around in a really interesting way. He's just doing so many interesting choices as Skeletor, which is good, because you know the actor playing He-Man's not a great actor, and one of them has to be doing a great job.
You know, it's so funny because like the most iconic fantasy and sci-fi movies, if there's like makeup involved or costumes involved, the villain or like the interesting character in those movies, the actor has figured out how to take what they're physically wearing and use it to define how the character moves and how they talk and stuff. You know, like you mentioned, you talked a lot about like how he moves and his face and stuff. And that's so, so important because he's always like sneering.
Yes.
Like he's always kind of sneering when he's talking. And then his eyes are always looking around. Like you said, that's a really important part, which like that just, a way an actor moves their eyes really enforces how you feel in the moment, right?
Yes,
if he's just kind of staring forward like deadpan, it makes it feel one thing. But if he's always looking around like that, it's always like, oh, he's clever, or he's always thinking about things, or he has these like dark thoughts, right?
Right.
And then it's like the combination, and it's so funny to like to heavily analyze this like character that's based on a fucking plastic toy,
right?
But Frank Langella took it to that degree.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Because when you combine his like darting eyes, like you said, with his sort of like smug, like his voice is like smug and deep for the most part.
Yeah, yeah.
Then he has this sort of like rattling kind of scream when he gets upset.
Right.
And it's just so good on so many different levels. Like I you know, recently for the LasterCast, we watched all the Planet of the Apes movies, like the classic ones from the 60s and 70s. And you could tell, like, Roddy McDowall, who becomes, like, the Andy Serkis of that franchise, you know, that he knows how to move like an ape and move his eyes and his mask. And you can manipulate the mask. It's the same thing that Frank Langella does. It's like he manipulates the mask in such a way that it feels organic. It feels like, oh, there's this fucking bone dude right here.
Yeah.
It's not just Frank Langella in a mask, you know? The one thing that always kind of strikes me as super interesting is that, like, he's got a thing over his nose.
Yeah.
That, like, it's not like, I'm trying to think, there's something, okay. Yeah, we reviewed Fallout on Comic Books Transformed, and the one of the characters, the ghoul, like, has no nose, right? It's like a Voldemort thing.
Yeah.
Like, Skeletor in the comics and cartoons and stuff, he has no nose because he's a fucking skeleton face, right? But in this, Frank Langella has a nose, but they tried to make it look like he doesn't. Right. But even that, he uses to his advantage and his effect, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he's so good. The way, like, because I don't know, I'm kind of rambling, I'm talking so much, but, like, just what he chooses to say in an aggressive way, what he chooses to say in a sort of, like, oh, I don't care, like, you mean nothing to me kind of way. It's like every fucking scene with him, every scene is great.
Yeah. He's scary. He's very scary for young kids.
Yeah.
He's terrifying. You said before you want to talk about the mercenaries. Let's talk about the mercenaries, because at one point, you know, so we don't have to go through the narrative, but, you know, He-Man and his friends go through it. By the way, the portal is such a cool design, too. They go through a portal to Earth, 1987 Earth. They meet Courtney Cox and her boyfriend, Julie and Kevin. I think they're good. They do a good job, these kids. I think it was smart to give them something that they're going through, which is they're breaking up because her parents died, and she feels guilt over her parents dying and all that. And the Skeletor he has one key, but he wants both keys. So he's tracking them from Eternia. So he says, before we go in with our troops, let's send like an advanced guard. And it's very much like the scene in Empire Strikes Back with the what do you call it? The bounty hunters. But, this is interesting because I like these characters, but I feel like this was an opportunity to put more of the recognizable characters in. My guess is that Mattel told them, no, do new characters because those will be new toys, right? The only one of those that is original is Beast Man.
Right.
But, you know, it could have been, Stinkor or any, you could have been, you know, all of those people. But it ends up being Bleed, who's like a human with like a bald head, and he has like two katanas. Sarad, who's kind of like, he looks like he's a lizard person, but with like armor on.
Yep.
Beastman, but this Beastman doesn't speak, and he has his hair like in a samurai like bun. Karg, who's the weirdest looking. Karg kind of looks like he's a monster, but he's got like kind of like a monkeyish face. But also like a like an 80s perm, like a big hair. It's very weird looking. And he does a lot of the talking for some reason.
Yep.
Do you remember this is a random memory for me. The Sarad toy.
No, I don't. What's the deal with that?
All right. So the Sarad toy, you would never do this now, by the way, because it's so dangerous. But inside of it had a flint, basically like a cigarette lighter. Like, you know, like you scratch the wheel and it makes a spark. You would do that, and then sparks would shoot out of Sarad's mouth. And I could still smell the smoke from that toy. I remember getting it and opening it. Like, for some reason, I have, like, the most distinct memory of getting that toy.
Yes.
We were in a car. We must have been going somewhere.
Yeah.
For the family or whatever. And they were like, let's just get Mike a figure so he could shut the fuck up and not have to deal with him. Because I just remember we're in a car where someplace different. They give me this toy. I open it, and I'm like, making the sparks come out of its mouth endlessly.
You probably got it off from the Toys R Us that was off Highland Boulevard by Newdorp, right?
No, I you know, when I was a kid, I lived in Brooklyn, so my Toys R Us was on Belt Parkway in Brooklyn. Now it's a, what is it now? I think now it's a Target.
Target. I was gonna say, All right. So like with that whole sequence, right? First of all, Karg. I fucking love Karg so much. He kind of looks like he looks like a critter from like the movie Critters, but
Oh yeah, it does.
like tall.
An
Like he looks
evolved
like
critter.
yeah, he looks like a crit like if they did like a Jeff Goldblum thing where they took like, you know, a fly and Jeff Goldblum, it's like you took a critter and my aunt and you put them together, that would be Karg, right? And instead of having the black critter here, they have like this white perm. He's great though. His acting's great. I think that the guy that played Karg was on like an episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where he played
Really?
like a coke fiend or something like that. But that scene is 1,000%. They're just like, let's just do that scene from Empire Strikes Back. It's
Yes.
exactly that. The only difference is that, like, in the Empire Strikes Back scene, Darth Vader's given the orders, and in this, Skeletor's given the orders, but they make sure that, like, Evelyn announces who each person is. They're like, Blade, you
Yeah.
know, Karg. And it's supposed to be this intimidating thing. You mentioned how like they could have had some of the regular guys on there. I think like obviously Trapjaw would have been one of the
Yes.
people, right? And then what's the is the fucking lizard guy? Is his name just literally Lizard Man? I can't remember.
I
The
can't
one,
remember either.
yeah, there's the one with like the tail, and I think he's got like a kind of like a boulder where his hand would be. Like I think it would be like that guy and Trapjaw and Beast Man, and I don't know, like the Cyclops guy, right? Like it would be those guys. But I just remember when those mercenaries do show up, they beat the shit out of that one guy that you mentioned before.
Yes.
And then at one point, Kevin is by himself and they jump him. And it's so funny, like he just yells, "Get out of here!" But like the look on his face, he looks so scared when they show up. It's really funny, you know? It's
I
good
mean, it's
acting right there.
ridiculous. From their point of view, this is crazy. And they burn
That
their school down.
right.
And that scene, I think, is pretty well put together and menacing, where like they're going after Courtney Cox and she's crawling under the stage, and Blade is like putting the swords down in between the boards, and like she's going around them, and then she throws like some bleach or ammonia in Beastman's
Beastman.
face. They burn the whole fucking school down.
Yeah, no, it's like totally menacing. What like when they show up and it's violent. There's blood on, you know, Kevin's face after he fights them. And then one thing that I'll always remember, because there's certain things that like you just always remember as a kid. I'll always remember when he has that collar on his neck, when Evelyn puts the collar on his neck, because it changes his voice and his demeanor and stuff like immediately once he gets the collar on, right? He's just like very monotone, like in his voice, but then it's like synthesized and he just has like no control whatsoever. And that just kind of always stuck in my mind, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Again, that's a great example of like the mixing of the mundane and the fantastic, right? They're in her house, the table is knocked over. They put this like thing on his neck that makes him talk in this like a mechanized way. It's like it's sort of like a it's like a lasso of truth, but it's like sci-fi. And then Evelyn has this sort of like portable hologram projector that she shows him the key on. So like this stuff really works well. And I think one of the reasons why it works well is because it's 1980s 35 millimeter film lighting. So it's got that like really rich darks and shadows and lighting that it makes the whole world seems kind of interesting. You and I could, we've already gone an hour. You and I could go all day talking about Master Universe. So I guess before we do wrap up, I want to talk about some of these other performances.
Of course.
God, there's so many good ones. Let's Billy Barty as Gwildor. Again, I think just like Frank Langella, I think he's holding up more than his end to make the movie interesting. Like he's doing a lot, and they give him a lot of important lines. They give him a lot of like, like when Kevin's like, "Oh, I'm just a nobody," and he's like, "Oh, everybody is important," or whatever he says. Like, like he's like such a good actor, and he's like the heart of the movie.
Absolutely. Yeah, he says something like, "There's only one of you anywhere." He says something like that, right? Yeah. Yeah, and he's funny too. I mean, all the kind of comic relief moments are like essentially Gwildor moments, right? Is where he's talking to the cow. He thinks the cows are like the sentient beings on the planet. He's got at one point he's wearing like sunglasses and like a woman's hat and like a boa and stuff,
The
right?
80s. You have to do that in the 80s.
When he shows up, he's like face down in the water, like when they land on Earth, and he's like kind of almost drowning, and then like water comes out of his ears, right? When he, but I always think about him from like Willow, because he's like the elder guy in Willow, right? Like the right. He kind of always plays this kind of like wily character that's also wise, like almost like a Yoda type character. And that's what he is in this too. Like
Is
he's like
he Legend
silly.
too, or am I misremembering?
Honestly, I've actually never seen Legend, so I couldn't tell you. He probably is.
There's a lot of little people in that movie.
I mean, is he in like the fucking Wizard of Oz?
I don't know if he's that old. Billy, yes, he is in Legend. He is in Legend. He plays Screwball in
Okay,
Legend.
Screwball. Okay, there you
No,
go.
he's not in The Wizard of Oz, but he's in Over the Rainbow, which is a movie about
Oh,
the Wizard of Oz.
yeah, that fucking weird ass movie.
That
So, I
movie that's
mean,
just racist against little people.
right.
Did you watch the cursed films on that? On Wizard of
Yes.
Oz? Is that where you
Yes, it was fantastic.
Yeah, that's where I learned about that movie, because that movie like does not exist anywhere. You like can't find that movie.
Right. You kind of see like scenes from it, and you feel kind of dirty watching it, you know? But just like he's so good. If we want to talk about performances, you know, we've already mentioned Frank Langella. I really think we need to talk about Evelyn
Yes,
and Meg
Meg Foster.
Foster. One of the funny things when I was doing a little bit of research was, they actually wanted her to wear contacts because they felt like her eyes were not like the Evelyn character's eyes in the cartoon. And it's just like, holy shit, are you shooting yourself in the foot?
Like, that's
If
the
you
reason you hire her, is because of her crazy eyes.
Her eyes are fucking insane. And you were talking about like the lighting and the way that this film looks with on the film it's shot. Like one thing they do really well in this movie is like accentuate her fucking amazing eyes, you know?
Absolutely. And her design is really cool. I like
Yeah.
the design. And again, like, she plays her as very sexual and sensual and having like a sexual power. Like, she really is like, I'm beautiful and I can be a trickster because of my beauty. And I think
Right.
her performance of Evelyn absolutely affects the way Evelyn is going forward in like the Kevin Smith show, and even like the way what's her name plays her in the Kevin Smith show, the one from Game of
Lena
Thrones.
Headey.
And the idea that her and Skeletor have a relationship. Like, she is Evelyn
Yes.
for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this movie like does things. It like raises up, it elevates the source material, right? Because, you know, if we look back at these cartoons and stuff, like you look back at the original Transformers, you look back at the original He-Man, and through nostalgia, you're like, it was amazing. These characters are so iconic, but they're not as good as you remember. It's like the stuff that comes later that's based off of it. That it's the movies, really, because they become more serious, more dynamic. There's this thing when they're making the movie that they feel like, oh, this has to be more complicated, or these characters have to have more depth, right? One thing, I know we're talking about characters, but one thing I did not mention that I really want to mention is the screenwriter. He also worked on other things too. He worked on The Muppet Show. He worked on The Dark Crystal. He wrote The Dark Crystal. David O'Dell wrote The Dark Crystal. So like he has this experience working with this sort of like prop stuff, this fantasy stuff. And I just think that like you have to take the source material and make it into something more complex. Just as a side note, and we've talked about Superman a lot, David O'Dell, who wrote Masters of the Universe, also wrote the 1984 Supergirl movie too.
Oh, he did.
Yes.
Interesting. Well,
Which, once again, that's another movie where it's like there's this fantasy setting, this space
yeah, yeah.
setting, and then it's like suburban small town setting
Yeah,
too.
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that about him.
But is there any other performances that you wanted to talk about too?
There's a lot of good ones. Teela is played by Chelsea Field. I always, when I was a young, like had a thing for her. Like, I think she's really good. She plays Teela is very, very brassy and tough, which I loved. Especially because, like, an early draft had She-Ra in it. And I think a lot of what was going to be She-Ra's role was given to the Teela character. You've got this actor, John Cypher, as Man-at-Arms. He's taking it very seriously. He's really doing it. Probably the other big one is James Tolkien as Detective Lubick.
Oh my God. We
know him as the principal from Back to the Future. He's playing it so heavy, but it's also comedic, especially like when he starts to like get involved. Like I've said this before on the show, like one of my favorite lines is when they shoot a laser at him and he's like, "Oh, no one takes pot shots at Lubick," and he starts shooting at the monsters with like a fucking shotgun.
Yeah.
And then at the end, he wants to stay an attorney. He like found an attorney and like girlfriend, and he wants to just live there.
Yes.
He adds so much to the human shit.
Yeah. It's so funny. Yeah. She looks like a young Sharon Stone and she's just immediately in love with him. Like he's sitting on a throne. He looks like a Roman emperor and she's just like looking down at him adoringly. You know, it's so funny that the guy that plays Man at Arms, his name is like John Cypher, where I feel like Lubick is the Cypher character for the audience, where he's just kind of constantly like, "What is this shit? This is crazy. This is nuts.
This you is know, fucking Twilight Zone."
Right.
A lot of lines like that. Or like he calls them cultists or hippies. At one point, he's got the cosmic key and he's like, "Do you think this could be Russian?"
Right. Yeah. So he basically kind of represents like what a person from our time would be thinking during all this nonsense. And I mean, he's just such a fun actor. Whenever he's on screen in anything, he always gets everyone's attention. So it's just like, you have Frank Langella, you have Meg Foster, you have him, you have Billy Barty, you know, like all these people in this movie are fucking great, you know? And then like the teenagers who they're really the characters that actually have arcs in this movie.
Yeah.
Like I guess Skeletor kind of has an arc. He-Man absolutely does not have an arc.
No.
But like the two people that actually do have arcs, I mean, especially Courtney Cox has the arc in the movie, right?
Yeah.
But it's like they're the young, nobody knows them actors, and it's Courtney Cox, right? And then the guy who plays her boyfriend, that's Barry Livingston, and he's fucking like he's from like Star Trek Voyager and stuff. You know, so like there's just a lot of fucking talent on this movie.
You know what's funny about Courtney Cox is she's not like my favorite actress. I mean, I think she's very good, but just somehow in my life, she's been in three of my favorite movies. Like when I was a kid, this was my favorite movie. When I was like 13 or whatever, like my favorite movie was Ace Ventura. Yep. And then when I got older, my favorite movie was Scream. And she's in that. Like she's made it in so many of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
But no, she's so cute in this. You feel for her. Again, like she's, you know, if she wasn't good, a lot of it would fall apart. Like a lot of these performances, if they weren't in place, this stuff wouldn't work. You know, her like fear and her heartbreak like makes it all sort of work. Yep. And I still at the end like get moved when like they go back in time and her parents are alive and she meets up with Kevin in the street and they're like, it's like this great happy ending. And then that little like marble that they got from the sorceress. The sorceress, by the way, played her mother in Friends. The woman who played the sorceress played Ross and Monica's mom in Friends. What's her name?
Christina Pickles.
Yeah, Christina Pickles. Great name.
Yeah. Man, that's a cool little bit of trivia right there. That's interesting. No, I mean, like, there's certain things in this movie that when you watch it over and over again as a kid, it just kind of sticks with you. There's the mercenaries beating the shit out of the boyfriend and attacking her in the school. There's when Skeletor first makes his entrance. There's one thing we got to mention is that like Skeletor like addresses everyone in Eternia by like being projected super high. It's super epic. There's this one fucking shot where it's like his projected face and He-Man's looking up. And
that's how He-Man's introduced.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, it's like straight out of a comic book. Then there's the part where Evil-Lyn pretends to be Courtney Cox's mom,
which is so fucked up. Yeah. It's so. But you know what's funny is, even as like a 4-year-old, I saw it coming a mile away. Like,
yeah.
It's so funny that like the thing she the gamut she plays is that they're like spies. She's like, "We're doing some very important work, so we had to run away." Courtney Cox is like, "Sure, okay." And then the mom's like, we really need the key. And she's like, sure, no problem. I'll get you that key.
I'll go steal this from Gildor. Yeah, yeah.
We haven't talked.
That, I mean, that,
yeah.
Go ahead.
One of those things for me is He-Man flying around on the disc. That's, I think, a really cool scene. And then that culminates in the top of the roof where, like, there's like 100 stormtroopers and He-Man like beats the shit out of like a good 25 of them. Like He-Man's like, they've got both of his arms and he kind of like pulls up, like they kind of fly away. Like, the physical, Dolph Lundgren got the physicality really well. Like, you felt like that was the He-Man you knew. Like, when he knocks over the big statue, that's the He-Man you know, who's just like pure, physical power,
strength, power,
or the very, very erotic scene where Blade is whipping He-Man and it looks like Skeletor's like coming while he's watching it.
Oh my god, yes, yeah,
all these things stand out.
I know, just think about all this shit that we've listed from this movie that often gets talked about as like a bad movie or talked about as a joke. It's so fucking good. One other thing we should point out is that the guy who plays Blade, right, the one that's whipping He-Man, that guy was like the sword expert on the movie. He's one of the stuntmen, you know. His name was Anthony DeLongis, right? And you know, they end up making this character for him to play, and I think he does a great job.
And even in the writing, like, there's a one line that implies so much where he goes to fight He-Man and he's like, I've waited a long time for this. And you kind of like, ooh, what's the history between Blade and He-Man that, like, there's some beef there.
Well, I don't think he dies either, right? At the end, like, all the mercenaries get away. The only one that gets killed is, that's another thing that you remember from this movie, is that Skeletor gets mad and he kills Sauron.
Well, like you were saying before, like, and we've said this before when we've talked about He-Man, because we've recorded about He-Man a lot, and we've recorded about Power Rangers and Ninja Turtles.
Fuck yeah.
A lot of these things that people love as kids, if they don't go away, they actually get better. There are some, like, weird, gatekeepy neckbeard guys that are like, I don't like this new thing. And to me, that's always so counterintuitive, because the thing will fade away and die if it doesn't get reinvented. And the cool thing that happens with this stuff is a younger audience who liked it as kids reinvent it. I've said this before about Master Universe. I think it's only gotten better. It got better and better and better and better and better. And to me, the best entry in the whole franchise is She-Ra Princesses of Power.
Fuck yeah.
And this is a step towards that. Like, it could have died with the cartoon. This movie, as much as people saw it as a failure, I think is a big leap towards it getting better. And a lot of, like, what's in current Master Universe stuff and She-Ra stuff, I think, comes from this movie. I mean, I'd have to go back and watch a lot of it, but there's stuff from Master Universe movie that's homage in She-Ra Princesses of Power. Particularly, I remember one Hordak talking to all of Etheria, like the way Skeletor does with that big projection. I remember when I saw that, I was like, oh, that's straight out of the Master Universe movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And now, supposedly, Amazon is making a live-action She-Ra show.
What? Okay.
Yeah, so I'm down with that. And you know, since this movie came out, there's been a Masters of the Universe film in development hell since, like, the 80s. Now they're like, oh, we cast somebody. Like, I'll believe it when I see it. But supposedly it's supposed to be happening. But whatever, like, I'm for it. It just only gets better.
Yes, totally agreed. You know, I always think about this movie the way I think about my favorite movie of all time, which is The Transformers, the movie. And it's just like, things are darker, they're more intense, they're better than they are in the actual cartoon. It's all about toys and, like, just trying to make money off of toys, but somehow through all that greed, something fun and imaginative is created. And
I always resist when people say, oh, well, it's just a toy or whatever. It's like, you know, there was a time in history where the church ran everything, so all the great artists were employed by the church, so they did illustrations of biblical stories. Like, the person who has the money is the person who dictates stuff. But the people that are hired, the artists and artisans that are hired, they put into it true artistry.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So who cares if that's the way it started?
Yes. Yeah. I'm so glad that like at this point we were able to talk about Masters of the Universe and bring it to like Renaissance painting. You know?
course.
That's what
Of
we do
course.
on your show, man. I fucking love it.
This movie, by the way, one of the first, talk about ahead of its time. It has a post-credit stinger, which every movie has now. And this was like, this and Ferris Bueller are the earliest ones that I remember. And it's such a it was such a tease that never came. Skeletor pops his head out. Well, Skeletor dies exactly like Palpatine. And he pops his
Does
head out, he's like, I'll be back. And that promise was never fulfilled.
It's funny because they were going to make a sequel to this, and
Yeah.
they even went so far as to make sets and costumes, and then they used some of that stuff for the movie Cyborg.
Yes, I've seen that. They thought this was gonna be a big hit, and I think it just came out the wrong time, man. I don't know. Who knows? It's such a crapshoot. You know what I mean? Like, there are so many great movies in history that were not successes when they came out, and movies that are successes that no one gives a shit about, like fucking Avatar.
Wow, that is like the best example right there. Holy shit.
Well, Pete, thank you so much for being here. We can talk for another 5 hours about this movie, but I feel
Easily.
like we've given a good episode.
Yes.
What's going on your channels? What's go? Oh, I should say that you and I on Comic Books Transformed have been covering this season one, parentheses, not really, of Doctor Who. What else is going on in your world?
It's funny you said we gave a good episode. That's what you've been doing on my channel, man. You've been giving good episodes on Doctor Who, and I'm actually really excited to talk about this next episode of Doctor Who with you, because I feel like they're taking pot shots at me and stuff in this next
Is
episode.
it about a bunch of middle-aged white guys doing podcasts?
It's close. It's close. There's definitely like a YouTuber vibe. There's not middle-aged men though, luckily. No. Okay, so I have two shows, Comic Books Transformed and The LasserCast. On Comic Books Transformed, we cover movies and streaming shows that have been adapted from comic books. We just finished reviewing Fallout, which is this really great show on Amazon Prime based on a video game. And we're going to move on to The Acolyte, which is a Star Wars
Ooh.
live action show set in the High Republic time, which you and I have covered on my
Can I
channel
ask
before
you,
too.
what are your going into that, right? What are your expectations? What do you think? Do you think it's going to be good? Do you think it's going to be bad? Do you not know?
Yeah, I think it's gonna be bad. But that's not just to be like I'm a cynical middle-aged white dude. It's like
It looks bad. It doesn't look good. I'm hoping that it's another Andor where I didn't care about it and then it blew me away. But it looks like it's probably going to be more like another
Obi-Wan.
Obi-Wan.
And that's what I'm expecting. Brian and I have been like very fortunate because like the last three or four things that we've covered, we've actually really enjoyed, like X-Men 97 and Fallout. And then there was something before that we really loved too. But yeah, we think this one's going to be kind of rough to watch. But we'll make some fun. We'll have some fun times talking about it. Over on the LasserCast, Danny and I have been covering basically apes and vampires for a couple of weeks now. We've been reviewing the Interview with the Vampire TV show, which is fucking amazing. Danny and I have been covering that, and then we covered every single Planet of the Apes movie that's ever been made. Like Danny's covered them all. So if you like any of that stuff, come on over to the LasserCast too.
All right, we end every episode by saying go bye bye. Can you say go bye bye like Skeletor?
Oh, I was gonna say when you
Good
told me to say go bye bye, I was gonna say good journey.
Journey.
But
You
no.
can end
I'll
by
say it
saying
like,
good journey.
but this time I'll say it like Skeletor. I like that challenge though. You'd be like, go bye bye.